Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in Deuteronomy chapter 17. I'm going to do verses 1 through 20, the entire chapter. We'll call this one The Justice System and Israel's Kings. Our context is this. In the last chapter, chapter 16, we looked at a summary of the three famous feasts, the three required feasts of Israel, and then there were some laws concerning the justice system. We're going to take that up again in this chapter. Some more regulations concerning the justice system. So we start now in Deuteronomy 17:1. You shall not sacrifice to the Lord your God an ox or a sheep which has a blemish or any defect, for that is a detestable thing to the Lord your God. Now, actually, this verse is a little bit out of place. It seems to me it belongs with the very end of chapter 16, the last two verses of which concerned forbidden forms of worship, no Asherah poles besides the altar, no pillars. And so here is no improper sacrifices to the true God. So it kind of fits that better. I don't know who is responsible for these chapter divisions, but sometimes they divide it in the craziest places. Now, why should there not be a defect of any offering offered to the Lord? Two reasons. One, sacrifices had to be of value to the offerer. You don't want to give your cheap stuff to God. Reason number two is it took a perfect sacrifice to atone for sins. So that means that the sacrifice should be a perfect type, a perfect animal, a perfect type for the perfect antitype, Jesus, who was also perfect and without sin. So that is an easy symbol there, that perfect animal. Let's look at some other scriptures that talk about perfect sacrifices. Leviticus 1:3, if his offering is a burnt offering from the herd, he shall offer it a male without defect. He shall offer it at the doorway of the tent of meeting that he may be accepted before the Lord. He shall offer it a male without defect. Malachi 1:8, but when you present the blind for sacrifice, is it not evil? And when you present the lame and sick, is it not evil? Why not offer it to your governor? Would he be pleased with you, or would he receive you kindly, says the Lord of hosts. And what Malachi is saying there, you wouldn't give a sickly, worthless animal to the king, the human king, the human governor. Why would you do that to God? Exodus 12:5, your lamb shall be an unblemished male, a year old. You may take it from the sheep or from the goats. It's talking about Passover. We go now to Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 2 through 5. If there is found in your midst, in any of your towns, which the Lord your God is giving you, a man or a woman who does what is evil in the sight of the Lord your God, by transgressing his covenant, and has gone and served other gods and worshiped them, or the sun, or the moon, or any of the heavenly host, which I have not commanded, and if it is told you, and you have heard of it, then you shall inquire thoroughly. Behold, if it is true, and the thing certain, that this detestable thing has been done in Israel, then you shall bring out that man or that woman who has done this evil deed to your gates, that is, the man or the woman, and you shall stone them to death. Now the evil that is being looked for, inquired about in the midst of Israel, is probably in particular the evil of idolatry, which is later described here. So we're going to assume this is what they're talking about. Notice that the idolatry includes the heavenly bodies, the sun and the moon and the heavenly host. Now, we often think of idolatry as referring to animals like ox or idols like Astarte, but also the heavenly bodies. That was an object of idolatry too. In fact, it happens more often than you might think. And the Israelites were good at that too. Let's look at some scriptures. 2 Kings chapter 17, verse 16. They forsook all the commandments of the Lord their God and made for themselves molten images, even two calves, and made an Asherah. All right, that's the golden calf worship. That's typical idolatry. You take an animal, make an idol of it. And an Asherah, there's your wooden pole for Astarte. But also at the end of verse 16 in 2 Kings 17, they worshiped all the host of heaven and served Baal. The host of heaven, those are the stars. So they made gods out of stars. Now, I know stars are impressive, but to make a god out of them? 2 Kings 21:3, for he, this is referring to Judah's king Manasseh, for Manasseh rebuilt the high places which Hezekiah his father had destroyed, and he erected altars for Baal and made an Asherah, the typical Baal and Astarte gods, as Ahab king of Israel had done, and worshipped all the host of heaven. So Manasseh worshipped the stars. 2 Kings 21:5, for he, referring again to Manasseh, built altars for all the host of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Lord. I mean, he had altars right there in the temple precincts. That's pretty sick. 2 Kings 23, 4 through 5. Then the king, this time it's referring to Josiah, commanded Hilkiah, the high priest, and the priest of the second order, and the doorkeepers, to bring out of the temple of the Lord all the vessels that were made for Baal, for Asherah. So they had idols right there in the courtyard, which is disgusting, and for all the host of heaven. So they had vessels, sacred vessels for libations, I guess, to offer libations to the host of heaven. That's the stars. And Josiah burned them outside Jerusalem in the fields of the Kidron and carried the ashes to Bethel. He did away with the idolatrous priests, etc., 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 etc. And he did away with those who burned incense to Baal, to the sun and to the moon and to the constellations and to all the host of heaven. So you see, star worship, heavenly body worship, was everywhere in Israel, which, of course, they picked up from the Canaanites in the land into which they had come. Now notice in verse 4 that the Israelites were to inquire thoroughly to see whether someone was committing this evil idolatry. That inquiry showed that due process was required. And notice that the thing had to be determined certainly. Behold, if it is true, and the thing certain, not probable, but certain, beyond a shadow of a doubt and to a reasonable certitude. So this was not a witch hunt. There was due process involved. Now in verse 5, the man and woman who had committed this idolatry is to be carried to the gates. Why the gates? Because that's where the courts were held. Gates of the city. It's where the elders sat, the judges sat. That is the man or the woman. Notice that women were not spared stoning. An idolatrous woman was not spared stoning because she was a member of the fair sex. She got blasted too. Idolatry is pretty serious. And of course, the stoning, as I'm sure you know, the witnesses cast the first stone, as we'll see here in just a minute. This kept the witnesses from making rash accusations, because it's a serious thing to stone somebody to death, and a witness might stand there with a stone and says, you know, I falsely accused this guy, now I'm going to murder him? Ooh. So the law had built-in safeguards, their procedural safeguards, to guard strict justice. We now go to Deuteronomy 17, verses 6 and 7. On the evidence of two witnesses or three witnesses, he who is to die shall be put to death. He shall not be put to death on the evidence of one witness. The hand of the witnesses shall be first against him to put to death, and afterward the hand of all the people. So you shall purge the evil from your midst. Now here we see in the case of idolatry, you had to have two or three witnesses. Now was this a general rule for all criminal cases, in addition to capital crimes? Well, yes, as a matter of fact, it was. You had to have two or three witnesses to convict anybody of any crime. Let's look at Numbers 35:30. If anyone kills a person, their murderer shall be put to death at the evidence of witnesses, but no person should be put to death on the testimony of one witness. Well, that's capital crime. That doesn't illustrate my point here. How about this? Deuteronomy 19:15. A single witness shall not rise up against a man on account of any iniquity or any sin which he has committed, not just murder, not just a capital offense. On the evidence of two or three witnesses, a matter shall be confirmed. So there you go. This is quoted in the matters of church discipline carried over into the church by Jesus in Matthew 18:16. But he, this is the sinning brother, if he does not listen to you, take one or two more with you, so that by the mouth of two or three witnesses shall every fact may be confirmed. That's the second stage of church discipline. 2 Corinthians 13:1, this is the third time I am coming to you. Every fact is to be confirmed by the testimony of two or three witnesses. Paul relates it's coming to him three times, so he's got evidence three times. I guess he equates that with three witnesses. 1 Timothy 5:19, do not receive an accusation against an elder except on the basis of two or three witnesses. Hebrews 10:28, anyone who has set aside the law of Moses dies without mercy on the testimony of two or three witnesses. Of course, the author of Hebrews is quoting these various places in Numbers and Deuteronomy where it takes two or three witnesses. So you see, it's all through the law. It's all in the New Testament. Procedural justice. Without procedural justice, you don't have substantive justice. Now, the purpose of executing the idolaters is to purge the evil from your midst. Idolatry is like COVID-19. It spreads quickly, and the history of Israel proves beyond a shadow of a doubt that it did spread quickly. And so the idea is to cut it off at its source, kill the idolater instantly to stop it, because that's a serious thing to lose contact with the God that made the universe and the God that made the Israelites. Now, putting away the evil, it says, that could refer to the evil idolatrous deeds, or it could refer to the evil idolater, the person. I believe it refers to both. and noticed that not only was the evil at hand put away, but there was also a deterrent effect. Future evil was also put away because evil spreads, and once you get rid of the evil, if you get rid of the evil quickly, it won't have a chance to spread. We go down to Deuteronomy 17, verses 8 and 9. If any case is too difficult for you to decide, we're now moving from idolatry to the justice system. If any case is too difficult for you to decide between one kind of homicide or another, between one kind of lawsuit or another, and between one kind of assault or another, being cases of dispute in your courts, then you shall arise and go up to the place which the Lord your God chooses. So you shall come to the Levitical priest or to the judge who is in office in those days, and you shall inquire of them, and they will declare to you the verdict in the case. Now, Moses is speaking to the Israelites on the plains of Moab, which I forgot to mention. This is his second discourse. The first discourse is to avoid idolatry. The second discourse is mainly talking about the law, or a restatement of the law. And so he's talking to the Israelites. John Gill says that more particularly, he says, when Moses says, if any case is too difficult for you, he's more particularly referring to the judges in the cities of Israel. And of course, that ultimately is who's going to have to decide these cases, so I don't have a problem with that. Now, some examples of hard cases are just law cases are mentioned. One kind of homicide or another, that would be, is it murder, intentional murder, or is it unintentional manslaughter? Between one kind of assault or another, that could be, was the battery self-defense, or was it not self-defense? Being cases of dispute in your courts, John Gill says that would refer, for examples, to whether something was unclean or not. So anything, any legal issue that comes up, just examples are given to show that this refers to all law cases. Then you shall rise and go up to the place for which the Lord your God chooses. That's Jerusalem. Now this is talking about cases too difficult for the judges to decide, the local judges in the cities of Israel. So this is going up to, like going up to the Washington to let the Supreme Court decide it. Verse 9 says, so you shall come to the Levitical priest or the judge who is in office in those days. I'm assuming that's on appeal when they go to Jerusalem. It mentions a judge there. The judge who is in office, we'll assume that's the top judge, the supreme judge. John Gill says there's options there. It could be the supreme judge, or maybe it's judges plural. You shall inquire of them. Well, them, it's probably not referring to plural judges, in my opinion. It's referring either to the priest or the judges, whoever you're talking to. The authority is not exactly, the structure of the authority is not spelled out word for word. But whoever the top dog is, whoever the Supreme Court is, you're supposed to listen to him because there is no court of appeal from there. John Gill says about this judge in Jerusalem, I should rather think that the judge here, if a single person, is the president or prince of the great Sanhedrin who succeeded Moses and sat in his place, and of him and his court, the priests and Levites and Israelites that composed it, inquiry was to be made. So what Gill is envisioning here is in Jerusalem in the Sanhedrin, which eventually came to be called the Sanhedrin, you got the supreme judge and the priest who were helping that judge in making decisions. But at any rate, doesn't really matter. The point is that's the court from which there is no appeal. Jameson, Foss, and Brown say of this, quote, from their judgment, the Levitical priest and the judge, the supreme judge, from their judgment there was no appeal. And if a person was so perverse and refractory as to refuse obedience to their sentences, his conduct, as inconsistent with the maintenance of order and good government, was then to be regarded and punished as a capital crime. In other words, you disobey the Supreme Court, off with your head. Or not off with your head, they didn't do that. You get stoned to death. Adam Clark has an interesting comment about these Levitical priests who are helping the judge in the Supreme Court there. Clark says that the priests and the Levites were lawyers by, quote, birth and continual practice. So the Levites are lawyers. Don't think about that too much, usually. We go now to Deuteronomy 17, verses 10 through 13. You shall do according to the terms of the verdict which they declare to you from that place which the Lord chooses. In other words, obey the Supreme Court. And you shall be careful to observe according to all that they teach you, according to the terms of the law which they teach you, and according to the verdict which they tell you, you shall do. You shall not turn aside from the word which they declare to you, to the right or to the left. The man who acts presumptuously by not listening to the priest who stands there to serve the Lord your God, nor to the judge, that man shall die. Thus you shall purge the evil from Israel. Then all the people will hear and be afraid and will not act presumptuously again. Now, this disobeying of the Supreme Judge, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown's already mentioned, that warranted capital punishment. It states here explicitly in Deuteronomy, you shall purge the evil from Israel if you don't listen to the Supreme Judge. Now, verse 10 says, you shall do. I just take that as generic Israelites. John Gill says it's talking about the judges of the inferior courts. Got to do what the Supreme Court does. Notice in verse 10, it says, you shall be careful to observe according to all that they teach you, all that the Supreme Judge and the Levitical priest in Jerusalem tell you. So the judges of the inferior courts have to execute the judgment exactly as it was promulgated in Jerusalem. This is basic judicial procedure. I mean, no appeals court can say, well, Supreme Court, we don't like what you said. We're going to make the law different than that. In the American court system, that's absolutely unheard of. You don't do that. Same thing in the Jewish system. And verse 12, it says, the man who acts presumptuously by not listening to the priest, that could refer to all the priests on the Sanhedrin, as Gill said, or it could be the high priest. The problem with it just being the high priest is not always at the head of the Sanhedrin or a member of the Sanhedrin, but I suspect he mainly was. So I'm not going to get too hung up over exactly how the judicial system worked, except that they had a priest in Jerusalem who was a chief lawyer, a chief judge, and you got to obey him. We go now to Deuteronomy chapter 17, verses 14 and 15. When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your countrymen you shall set as king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not your countryman. Now here Moses is anticipating the time when Israel would ask for a king. He says, if you're going to ask for a king, it needs to be a Jewish king, not a foreigner, which of course makes sense. Just kind of like in America, our Constitution says our president has to be in America, not somebody else. We jump forward into the history of Israel and look at the end of the judges period under Samuel, and we see that the people asked for a king and it was not pleasing to God. So what Moses is doing here is by concession, he's saying, well, I'm not saying that God wants you to have a king, but if you're going to do it, these are the rules. So let's look at 1 Samuel 8, 4 and 9. Then all the elders of Israel gathered together and came to Samuel at Ramah. And they said to him, behold, you have grown old, and your sons do not walk in your ways. Now appoint a king for us to judge us like all the nations. But the thing was displeasing in the sight of Samuel when they said, give us a king to judge us. And Samuel prayed to the Lord. The Lord said to Samuel, listen to the voice of the people in regard to all that they say to you, for they have not rejected you, but they have rejected me from being king over them. So not only was Samuel upset, but God was upset about this king business. Like all the deeds, God continues to talk to Samuel, like all the deeds which they have done since the day that I brought them up from Egypt, even to this day, in that they have forsaken me and served other gods, so they are doing to you also. In other words, I feel your pain, Samuel. They rejected you, well, they rejected me too. Now then, listen to their voice. However, you shall solemnly warn them and tell them of the procedure of the king who will reign over them. So you see, God says, yeah, we're going to let the Israelites have a king. They're sinned. They have free will. They're using their free will to sin and act like idiots. But we are going to restrict them in their freedom so that they don't destroy themselves. So there have to be certain rules for the king. To have a king was contrary to God's ideal. Leviticus 20:23 says this, moreover, you shall not follow the customs of the nation which I will drive out before you, for they did all these things, and therefore I have abhorred them. And one of the things that the pagan Canaanites did is they all had kings, and that was one of the things the Israelites just had to imitate. And we'll see how well that worked out for them when we get to the story of the kings in 1 and 2 Kings and 1 and 2 Chronicles. It was a sort of a disaster. Very few righteous kings did they have. Now, interestingly enough, this command not to have a foreign king here in Deuteronomy 17, verse 15, that piece of scripture, that piece of the law, was the basis of the Pharisees' accusation of Jesus when they were trying to trick him up. When they asked him, they gave him a coin. On one side was the head of Caesar, and they said, is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar? Well, actually, they didn't give him the coin. Jesus gave him the coin. But the point is, they asked him, is it lawful to pay tribute to Caesar? And what they were trying to do is to get Jesus caught up, because if Jesus said, yeah, sure, it's lawful to pay tribute to Caesar, then the Pharisees would have said, yes, that means that if we pay tax to Caesar, that means Caesar is our king, and he is not a Jewish guy. He is a foreigner. He is a Gentile. And therefore, Jesus, you are breaking the law, so let's go out here so we can stone you. That's what they were trying to do. Now, of course, as Jesus had said, nah, we don't have to pay tribute to Caesar, then the Pharisees would have condemned Jesus to Caesar, to the Roman authorities, and said, this guy is a lawbreaker. He won't pay his taxes. Of course, Jesus got out of it by saying, render unto Caesar what Caesar's, render unto God what's God's. Keep your spheres of authority straight, and you won't have such problems. In verse 14, Moses is quoting what God told him, and he's telling the people, he's quoting the people as saying, I will set a king over me like all the nations who are around me. I already mentioned the fact that the Israelites were affected by all the idolatry around them. The environment often trumps what is right and godly, and I want to make an application of that here. How many Christians do you know? Oh, yeah, mankind's basically good because that's all they ever hear. Oh, sure, homosexual marriage is okay, quote-unquote marriage. That's okay because that's all they ever hear. And so then pretty soon they're acting like pagans. Deuteronomy 17, verses 16 through 17. Moreover, he, that's the king, the future king, shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way. He shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. Now, incidental detail here, why does God say don't go back to Egypt to multiply horses? Well, it's because Egypt had a lot of horses, as John Gill says. We see this in Isaiah 31:1. Woe to those who go down to Egypt for help and rely on horses, and trust in chariots because there are many, and in horsemen because they are very strong. But they do not look to the Holy One of Israel, nor seek the Lord. So Egypt was famous for horses. Now, what are some of the reasons why the Israelites were not to go to Egypt? The Israelite king was not to go to Egypt to get horses. Well, Adam Clark says one reason is because commerce with Egypt might lead to idolatry, which I'm sure it would. Another reason, says Adam Clark, is because if you go down to Egypt, what you're doing is you're showing you're trusting in military might, in chariots and horses, but you're not trusting in God. And not only that, if you trust in the Egyptians' military might, Adam Clark continues, Israel might be tempted to advance their dominion beyond Canaan. Remember, God only gave them Canaan. He didn't give them Syria or Mesopotamia or Egypt or any of that, or Persia or Iraq. Well, that's Mesopotamia, excuse me. He didn't give them all of that. He just gave them Canaan. If they start getting military thoughts because of their military strength, they're going to be headed for a fall. Now, the king is not to multiply horses and not to multiply wives. Well, that's exactly what Solomon did. He did both. He multiplied horses and multiplied wives. And, of course, Solomon was the greatest Egyptian king in the history of Israel. He was the top dog in the Middle East because of foreign affairs. Egypt was on the decline, Assyria was on the decline, and there was nobody there except him, and so he was the top dog. 1 Kings 4:26, Solomon had 40,000 stalls of horses for his chariots and 12,000 horsemen. 40,000 horses? Whew, that's more horses than any king should need, you would think. Well, that's his horses. He had 40,000 horses. How many wives and concubines did he have? Well, you know the nice round number of 1,000. 1 Kings 11:1 through 4, now King Solomon loved many foreign women along with the daughter of Pharaoh. Moabite, Ammonite, Edomite, Sidonian, and Hittite women. That's from all the pagan lands that surrounded Israel. From the nations concerning which the Lord had said to the sons of Israel, you shall not associate with them, nor shall they associate with you, for they will surely turn your heart away after their gods. Solomon held fast to these in love. Now, all these kings that he loved, it says he loved them. That's loved in a restricted sense. I doubt he even knew half of them, or a fourth of them. Who knows? He certainly didn't have sex with all of them. If he did, he was a better man than most. I don't believe he did. What kings would do is they'd get all these wives and concubines to make foreign alliances and also to be seen in the eyes of the public as a big shot. But these wives, princes, and concubines turned his heart away. For when Solomon was old, his wives turned his heart away after other gods, and his heart was not wholly devoted to the Lord his God, as the heart of David his father had been. Notice how sinful the early Israelite kings were. They had their morality was so basic. I mean, David killed somebody, and he had committed adultery with his wife before he killed him. Uriah the Hittite he killed, and Bathsheba the adultery. And then here Solomon is, got 1,000 wives and worshiping idols instead of God. I mean, that's serious business. So as weak as the church has been throughout the ages, as far as morality is concerned, it doesn't compare to how the Old Testament people of God, chosen people, how they acted, which of course is just to say that we all need a Redeemer very, very much, because mankind's sin is very, very deep and entrenched and ingrained. Now, there was nothing wrong with horses. They were probably used as a part of state equipage, as James Fawcett Brown put it, but it was wrong for a king to put his trust in the horses. There was another problem with king having a lot of horses. He might get proud about them, but even worse, he might use the horses to tyrannize his own people. Sort of like might tell you that your contracts with, if you're a landlord, your contracts are no good anymore because the king, Taliban Joe, has said so. Or the king, Taliban Joe, tells you that you have to take a chemical in your arm whether you want to or not, or you're going to lose your job or get fined by the government. Power, absolute power, corrupts and corrupts absolutely. Now, all of this idea of trusting in chariots and chariots and horses is summarized in a famous psalm in the King James Version. Some trust in chariots and some in horses, but we will remember the name of the Lord our God. It's a well-known hymn, a well-known chorus song that people sing all the time. It's a great object lesson. You better not rely on Donald Trump getting elected to protect your religious liberties, because it ain't going to happen, most probably. You better rely on God instead of your political leaders. Now, in verse 16, God is said to have said this to the Israelites: you shall never again return that way, return to Egypt. You'll never go back to Egypt. Well, it's not clear exactly when he said that. As John Gill points out, here's some options, and I think this first option is the right answer. When they were in the wilderness and they listened to the evil report of the 10 cowardly spies who complained about the leaders in Canaan being as tall as giants and the Israelites just like grasshoppers, and the walls of the city were fortified to the heavens. And they came back and the people said, whoa, Numbers 14:4. They said to one another, let's appoint a leader and go back to Egypt. As Keith Green said, so you want to go back to Egypt where it's safe and secure. Well, that's not God directly saying it. That's the people saying it. But since it's written in God's word in the Torah, that could be what is being referred to here. And I think it is. But even if that's not what is being referred to by Moses here, or by God through Moses, all of the miracles in the Exodus were designed to get them out of Egypt. So maybe when Moses is saying that God had said, don't go back to Egypt, the said there is not verbal, not meant to be taken as a verbal verb, a verbal action, but it's being meant to be taken as God's action. He's saying that his actions will speak louder than words. His actions are saying, get out of Egypt. I mean, after all, in the famous curses chapter in Deuteronomy 28, in verse 68, we read this: the Lord will bring you back to Egypt in ships by the way about which I spoke to you. You shall never see it again. And there you will offer yourselves for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves, but there will be no buyer. And of course, the implication is they would not go back. That's if they broke the law, they would be sent back. Well, obviously, they wouldn't want to do that. So God's speaking through his actions, through his laws, through his miracles. Don't go back to Egypt. We go now to Deuteronomy 17, verses 18 through 20, and we'll finish this chapter. Now it shall come about when he sits on the throne of his kingdom. This is the future king. He shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priest. It shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or the left, so that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom in the midst of Israel. Now, Adam Clark, in reference to the command that the king write down a copy of the law on a scroll while the Levitical priest watched him, Adam Clark says this is the surest way to make a king familiar with the law. The surest way to make him familiar with the law is to make him copy it by hand. Remember when your teacher says, I made you write 100 times, you will not talk in class? I still remember that in the sixth grade, Miss Tally. Oh my gosh, I had to write so many sentences because I couldn't keep my mouth shut in class. And I still remember it over half a century ago. But the thing is, her sentences were four lines long. So you write 54-line sentences, you're writing it 200 times. She was brutal. She was also one of my favorite teachers. I still remember her. Now, this writing a copy of a law on a scroll, the NIV Study Bible says that this was required procedure for vassal kings under the suzerainty treaties among the Hittites and others before and during this period. In other words, the vassal kings would have to write down the words of the treaty in front of their suzerainty king, their lord king, and they had to write it down so that everybody know what's in the law, and it would make the vassal king remember it. It would stick in his head. Now, this copy of the law was kept in the tabernacle, as John Gill says, Deuteronomy 31:26. Take this book of the law and place it beside the ark of the covenant of the Lord your God, that it may remain there as a witness against you. You know, we often think of the tablets of stone being in the tabernacle, but also a copy of the whole law was put into the tabernacle. Now, that copy of the law that was kept in the tabernacle was found, you recall, in 2 Kings 22:8. Then Hilkiah, the high priest, said to Shaphan, the scribe, I have found the book of the law in the house of the Lord. And Hilkiah gave the book to Shaphan, who read it. So somewhere, that copy that the kings wrote down was kept in the tabernacle. Well, actually, it wasn't the tabernacle by the time of the kings. It was the temple. And so the law was preserved. This idea that the king wrote down for the priest the law and then the priest put it into the temple, this was from John Gill. Now, verse 18 refers to this law, a copy of this law. Write a copy of this law on a scroll. Well, that phrase, this law, could refer to the whole Pentateuch. It could refer just to the book of Deuteronomy. Or it could refer to the part of the book of Deuteronomy that dealt with kings. I prefer to think it refers to the whole book of Deuteronomy. Now, the phrase this law is translated by the Septuagint as this Deuteronomy, this second law, as Adam Clark and John Gill point out, and that's where we get the name Deuteronomy for the book. The Jews don't call it Deuteronomy. I forgot what they do call it, but Septuagint Greek translation. So the Greeks gave us this idea of Deuteronomy, the second law. And if you think about it, as we've gone through here, Moses is rehashing a lot of the first law in his speeches to the Israelites, so second law does sort of make sense. It's not really a second law in the sense that the first law was abrogated and replaced by a second law. It's just merely a rehashing of the first law. All right, so the king in verse 19 is supposed to read it all the days of his life, supposed to keep it by him, observe the words of the law and these statutes. Why? Verse 20, so that his heart may not be lifted up. You read the law enough, you realize God's in control, not a king. I mean, you just can't help but read that. Now, the NIV translates that the king will not consider himself better than his brothers. His heart will not be lifted up, and that's what that means. The king is not above the law. As we say in America all the time, the president is not above the law, except for the current one, of course. You're not supposed to be above the law any more than the humblest subject in the realm was above the law. Nobody's above the law. In my humble opinion, this is the start of a process that eventually led to democracy and ordered liberty, where law rules and not individuals, where you have law to keep people from forcing your contracts to be broken because of a pandemic. So I can't collect rent from my tenants. And so therefore, but I still got to pay rent, pay mortgage payments and insurance payments to the financer of my rental property, but I can't collect rent from my tenants. A total injustice, but it was done by our U.S. government. Our court system knocked that down finally, after a lot of grief was caused. And now the latest thing is you got to take a vaccine whether you want to or not in order to work in America, the land of the free and the home of the brave. And we were told by our governmental authorities, we don't care about your personal freedom. Folks, there is nothing more important than this. The king is not above the law. It's in the book of Deuteronomy. It's in the Pentateuch. It's in there everywhere. God is the king. It's amazing to me. You read Middle Ages history, medieval history, and authority sometimes was put into a pope, and then sometimes it was put into an emperor, and so you had the classic conflict between the secular and religious authorities in medieval Europe. And then when the pope kind of got put down, then in the early modern era in Europe, the kings relied on the divine right of kings, where God gave them the right. They could say whatever they wanted to, and both of those are wrong. A pope is not above everybody. A divine right, a king claiming divine right, is not above everybody. It's God that's above everybody. And I think this process finally worked itself out in the American Constitution, which is sort of unique amongst governmental systems in the world. It's been imitated by many countries ever since. Thank God for that. Well, the whole idea, because we used to have a Christian culture, although we're now in the post-Christian culture, we used to be a Christian culture, and that idea was very strong. A king doesn't tell people what to do. Even in the Middle Ages, I've been reading a lot of medieval English history of English kings. They were constantly having to go to court. They were constantly rebuffed by the courts. You just can't take that property. And they did a lot of unjust things. And it took a while for the system to work out to where you ended up with, instead of having a divine right king, you had a constitutional democracy in England. But even kings were subject to the law in the Middle Ages many, many times. They had to go to Parliament to collect money so they could fight their wars and that sort of thing. Well, anyway, that's enough political science for right now. We are now finished with, well, one more point. Verse 20, God says, so that he, read the law, keep the law by you, king, so that he, the king, and his sons may continue long in his kingdom. This shows that it was expected that the crown of Israel was designed to be hereditary by God, as Adam Clark says. And that's what happens, of course, when we get to the king's period. So, ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with Deuteronomy 17. We're now ready to go in our next audio to Deuteronomy 18, verses 1 through 22. We'll look at financial provision for the priest and the Levites in that chapter. I hope you stay tuned for that, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.